I will call the this meeting of the Health Policy Committee to order, and we're going to get started even though we don't have a quorum as of yet. We're going to start off with taking testimony and presentations on the various bills on the agenda. We're going to start with House File 2826, Representative Bradley's bill. Representative Bradley, I understand this is going to be presented with the intent that it be considered or held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
I'm sure that's correct. I found the fiscal note last night, and I'm still in sticker shock, but it is appropriate for it to be held over, so that will be the final conclusion.
All right.
You'd like me to proceed?
Yes, please.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Not a new issue. I think it is an issue, though, that I think it's really important for the legislature to continue to consider. Minnesota is one of only two states, and I think even it's probably fair to say that ours is even more unique than others that have the equalization requirements, which says that you cannot charge a private pay more than a public assistance pay person in a nursing home. On the surface, that might sound like it makes some sense. I don't think, as I visited other states, however, that the dire predictions that sometimes people say if you repeal this have happened. I would also point out that I think in these times of opportunity, creativity, innovation, I really believe that current law stymies opportunities for innovation. It isn't just about, we have so much regulation, members, on nursing homes, and I think this committee has heard all about that. The notions that if we don't have this equalization, that somehow there will be substandard treatment for people who are on public assistance, I think just doesn't make sense. And I think we know the kind of specific regulation that goes on with nursing homes. I think it's time to make the step. The bill is fairly straightforward. The bill certainly would repeal that requirement. You have the bill before you if you have any specific questions on that. And then I think opens the door. Now, you also, I believe, have a fiscal note. I am a little surprised. I understand that if this is acted upon, there is a chance that some people might more quickly spend down to eligibility for medical assistance. I'm going to need to have a little dialogue with those who have put this together, because I think this is a little on the big side, particularly on the first biennium. It's as though instantly we're going to see nursing homes jumping their rates. I think if you understand the kind of pressures there are, and you're going to hear a little later from one of my constituents about families paying privately, and you know, they're not going to take kindly at all inordinate raises in their rates. So I think the market will control those kinds of things. I think what it'll do, though, is allow, as I said before, for innovation. Mr. Chair, with the pleasure of the committee, I do have a person here who is sort of underfoot this issue that I think would be great to testify. So if I could do that, I'd appreciate it.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Michael Klott, and I serve as president of the Lutheran Home Association based in Belle Plaine. Our organization serves seniors and persons with developmental disabilities in a number of different programs and services both in Minnesota and Wisconsin. I am also a member of Minnesota Health and Housing Alliance and a member of the Long-Term Care Imperative Work Group. I have a number of points that I'd like to raise about the repeal of rate equalization. First, the studies conducted by the business community have identified rate equalization as one of the reasons why Minnesotans have a historically low rate of insuring their long-term care needs, a dangerous trend if we look at the demographics. If the state will cover for long-term care services at the same service and payment level as they would otherwise receive, there is no incentive for personal responsibility. The original purpose for equalization of nursing facility payment rates, ensuring that medical assistance recipients have access to the same services as privately paying residents, has long been addressed through federal anti-discrimination statutes and the conversion to more third-party payers. Thirdly, many of the complications within the current payment system can be tied directly to rate equalization, from the timing of the rate notices to the single bed election to bed hold payments and the impact of changes in case mix timing and weights. Since all but two states, as Representative Bradley preference do not have rate equalization, we can look to other states and what happens to both Medicaid and private pay rates without this restriction, and what we have found is this. When given payment flexibility, facilities in other states are able to respond quicker to service needs of privately paying residents and do not raise the private pay rates to the levels often feared. Fifthly, a recent national study has shown that on average, Medicaid rates are between $12 and $14 a day under what nursing facilities need to meet their costs. They stay in business only through private pay and Medicare revenue. Minnesota does not have the same opportunity, which is why we continue to see nursing facilities closing their doors due to financial stress. Repealing rate equalization would at least give these facilities an option that they currently do not have. And lastly, as we increase the numbers of nursing facility residents whose care is paid for by health plans, the negative financial impact of rate equalization will grow. In other states, health plans match the private paying marketplace when negotiating payments with facilities. Not so in Minnesota, where we do not have a private pay price for our services. Instead, the managed care organizations are paying to the lowest common denominator, our Medicaid rates. And then on a very personal level, I am not a reimbursement expert, but I have studied this issue for a number of years. I've listened to both people for and against this. And as I referenced before, in serving both in Minnesota and Wisconsin, Wisconsin does not have rate equalization. There is this fear that not having rate equalization will mean that the rates will skyrocket out of control in the private pay sector. And that is a fear, quite honestly, that we have not seen materialize. And I've been serving over there for about 15 years. It just doesn't exist. At the same time, repealing equalization is going to cure everyone either. But I will also say that because that equalization is not in Wisconsin, there are facilities there that are surviving. And that's an important consideration when rate equalization repeal is taken in consideration as a whole. When we consider, as Representative Bradley suggested here, this important time in Minnesota's history, in the future of innovation and changing services for older adult services, this is an important piece of the puzzle. If the time to do it is now, and it will help organizations care for older adults, and I believe it will see organizations be able to survive and reposition in the marketplace. And that is why, over the time of years that I've studied this, that I believe in my heart that this is the right thing to do in the marketplace. It's the right thing to do for residents and their families. It's the right thing to do for caregivers, and it's the right thing to do for the communities which we serve. Mr. Chairman, members, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Klatt, is it?
Yes.
Klatt?
Either way, Mr. Chairman.
Either way. Representative Bradley, are there further witnesses?
I believe Ms. Cohen had asked to testify as well.
Do we want to hold questions until after we hear from everybody? Let's do that.
I think.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Patty Cullen, Vice President at Care Providers in Minnesota, speaking on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. Just a few additional comments to add to Mike's comments. You do have in your packet an issue paper from the Long-Term Care Imperative, and I do have a point of correction on that. This issue paper was done with the last version of the repeal of the rate equalization bill that was a phase-in. It was a zero fiscal note at that time because it was phased in over a longer period of time. The assumptions that we put in this issue paper were that eventually, maybe Representative Bradley would want to minimize the fiscal note, which the only way you can do that according to the department is to have a phase in. So the last point on the issue paper is not applicable for the bill as it currently stands. We do have some concerns with the fiscal note as it's been drafted, because there is an assumption that worst case scenario is going to happen and that there's no competition in the marketplace. Years ago, back when I started in the business, I think this issue would have had some validity. I think we had full nursing homes and we had little competition from other settings. So as a result, we would have folks that had a hard time finding an open bed. Not so today. With the proliferation of the housing with services industry, we have vacancies in nursing facilities. We have enough vacancies that some are closing because unless you have at least 95% occupancy, you get financially penalized, and so they struggle to stay alive if their occupancy is 90% or lower, and then they ultimately close, as you've seen over the last few years. So you cannot be in the marketplace and compete for the private paying dollars if you are going to charge a lot for your bed. Whether or not, if you have the same physical plant as your neighbor down the street, and they're only going to charge a 10% differential, you will not get people coming to your facilities if you up the differential. As Mike stated, the national studies in states without rate equalization show that there's a variance in the percentage that they charge private paying residents, but on average it's only about 10 to 15%. That's what you could expect. I also believe that as folks who are looking to taking care of their parents, and in my case my mother would be a private pay resident due to long-term care insurance, she is so glad she's in a different state. Because you can't buy additional services. You can't say, you know what, I want to pay for a newspaper, I want to pay for this meal, I want to pay for this meal, because rate equalization doesn't just mean the rates have to be the same. The services do as well. And so the flexibility that you may see in some other environments where you're able to say, you know what, I did save up some money, I am going to stay in a nursing home, and by the way, the median length of stay in a nursing home is under 50 days, so we're not talking about the vast majority of the folks staying for years in a facility and spending down, which is another point for the fiscal note. But you want to be able to give choices. I want to be able to give my mother choices. So that's the other concern that we have with the maintenance of the rate equalization is not just rates, it's also services. The final point is we do have some concerns with the impact that the third-party payers will have on our rate structure in the future. It's a great unknown. We just started January of this year with an increase in the number of days under the MSHO program. Even though rate equalization says that third-party payers are exempt from the rate equalization, the health plans, all of them in MSHO that we have talked to, are using the Medicaid rate as their rate. Because from their perspective with rate equalization, that's also the private pay rate. Even though we certainly understand the historical reasons for rate equalization being put in place in this state, and that some groups, this is a sacred law for them, we do think it's time to really take a look at what's the implications both to the services as well as to all of the payments. And the only other comment I would add to Mike's comment on personal responsibility is if folks have listened to the presentation that DHS has done around the state on the Transform 2010, I think it is the number, it's scary. Then the budget issues that would come before this committee in just a few years because of the percentage of Medicaid days is pretty scary. And I think there's been enough discussion in the business community and enough studies done in other states with the long-term care insurance take-up rate and our state being behind as a result that I think you need to look very carefully at the whole budget blowing up in the future unless we take many steps to address that, and this is just one of them. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cullen. Representative Bradley, anyone else?
I have no one else. If we probably have some people who would like to testify in opposition as well, and I certainly welcome their testimony too. So.
Anyone in the audience is here to testify in opposition? Seeing none.
What do we have?
Questions from members. Representative Finstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for Mr. Klatt. First of all, when you see my cousin Christine, congratulate her on the twins, please.
I will do. She's a wonderful staff member.
My question for you is you referenced in your testimony that you have work experience in Wisconsin also.
That is correct, Mr. Chairman, Representative Finstead.
So my question is, since we are one of two states with this right now, Wisconsin is not, can you just give me a little bit more about the quality of care, competition, what is it costing private versus government pay residents? Just give me kind of a little bit more in-depth picture, if you could, on the comparisons between the two.
Representative Finstead, Mr. Chairman, members, Wisconsin has a very respectable system and care system and has for a number of years.
been advocating more community-based type of care and delivery of services. In fact, the governor of Wisconsin, Governor Doyle, has an initiative right now to reduce or shift 25% of nursing home residents in more community type of settings. And I think Wisconsin has done, in overall, an admirable job in its community-based placement settings and reimbursement structures for the same. In the nursing home structure, however, everyone recognizes that it is important to have good quality nursing homes and that it is important for these nursing homes to be successful. In many areas of Wisconsin, it is like Minnesota, where you have rural areas and you have more of the metropolitan areas. Certainly the Twin Cities are part of that in Wisconsin. In our cases, we have two nursing facilities in Wisconsin, and they're both about $12 and some odd cents higher than the typical equalization rate or the medical assistance rate. Wisconsin's medical assistance rate is lower than Minnesota's, but their rate system is very significantly different. There's really only four rate structures in the nursing homes compared to Minnesota's. And many people are calling for changes in the way Wisconsin's reimbursement structure is developed. However, the competition, as Patty mentioned, there is this competitive drive to make sure that facilities don't charge exorbitant rates. That you, it is a common thing that you have this competition in the settings out there, and you're not going to be able to charge these premium type of rates that would be out there. I think there's a discipline not to do that. At the same time, there is, because of these alternative settings, as Representative Bradley mentioned, that on the fiscal note, that I think the fear that we're going to have a large fiscal impact in this area is mistaken. There is more of an impact where people are going to spend down their money is actually in the assisted living or senior apartments and senior services in Wisconsin. They're seeing that already. And I believe that's the same thing in Minnesota. We're going to see the spend down in the assisted living and other service areas versus the nursing home areas, which are seeing a declining days of care and delivery of services. And so in many respects, some of the same issues apply from Minnesota to Wisconsin. However, in Wisconsin, it is still my conviction that they've had a number of facilities close as well. There needs to be more shrinking of beds in both states. However, because there isn't rate equalization, some of these organizations are surviving as a result, and that is important. It is important that these facilities do survive and are able to continue delivering care, and repealing rate equalization would assist that.
Thank you, Mr. Platt. Representative Finstead?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick follow-up, and I appreciate you sharing that with us. You're a great resource and provide a lot of knowledge on this area, and I appreciate that. The fiscal note talks about, if this bill were to pass, we would have an initial jump off the ledge, I guess, of nursing homes, and it would increase rates by 10% the first couple years, and then the fiscal note says then about 5% each year thereafter. Could you tell me, from your experience in Wisconsin, have you seen prices being jacked 5% a year?
Mr. Clapp.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Finstead, members, I don't think you're going to see that. We have been typically raising more rates from the 3-5% range. And again, it's from a competitive standpoint. You do look at what your competition is doing, and we think that's healthy to do that. I will not say that it never ever occurs that there's a large rate increase, but I think there are times when factors actually precipitate that. In Wisconsin, like Minnesota, there were a number of facilities that were dealing with very large increases in liability insurance over the last several years. And I know some organizations made the conscious decision to raise the rates higher when they had that flexibility to do so. But overall, we don't see that. We see people who look at their operations, they look at the services that they provide, their relationships with their residents and family members, and their fiscal discipline, and they don't do that.
Thank you, Mr. Clapp. Further questions? Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That sort of reminded me of a benefit that you may not think about. The way the law works is if you have any medical assistance, then it applies to your entire population. That means that there are nursing homes that do not offer opportunities for people on medical assistance to be in their facility. They can't afford to. And it's sort of really kind of too bad. I mean, it's kind of an all or nothing. I think one of the other side benefits of this could be that doesn't become a barrier anymore as far as the potential of offering beds in facilities.
Representative Teese, yeah, just a quick follow-up on that, Mr. Chair. Do we know how much those, and I think this is I kind of like this idea, but do we know how much those private-only facilities pay? Maybe this was covered while I was up back. Pay relative to Medicaid rates?
Representative Bradley.
Mr. Chair and Representative Teese, to be honest with you, I don't know, and I don't know if there's any industry picture of private pay-only facilities. There aren't a whole lot of them, but there are some. I know I have one in my own community. Do you have any sense?
More, I don't know how much.
I guess we'd have to follow up.
That would just actually give us some insight, maybe, into where rates possibly could go. That's the only reason I
ask. It may, but you'd be careful. If you listen carefully, Mr. Chair and Representative, to Ms. Cullen's presentation, it is a barrier to doing things for people that they want and have the ability to pay for. And in facilities like the one I'm thinking about in Rochester, there's a fair amount of that. So I wouldn't be surprised part of the hire is because they're doing things that probably wouldn't be happening in a controlled facility.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Any further questions? Any further statement, Representative Bradley?
No, Mr. Chair. Out of respect to the chair, I'm prepared to allow the chair to hold us over. If you can get that thing I asked you to memorize.
The chair will hold House File 2826 over for possible inclusion into the omnibus bill.
Thank you very much, members.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, if I could try to position
Representative Bradley.
Our next set of bills, I think, are an interesting collection, and I suspect many of us have faced this, where you have a constituent who complains to you about paying more than they think they should be in a nursing home because conditions changed and the case mix verification didn't catch up. What you're seeing, I think, in the next three bills are an attempt to try to respond, and they're in three different ways. I would tell you from House File 2933 that I'm carrying, I'm not married to that solution, but I think the important part to me this morning is that we get that issue in front of this committee and sort of try to figure out in this combination what's the right thing. I think all three of these would be held over. But certainly I myself, and as they hold over, of course, that means that ultimately it will be my responsibility to kind of come back in an omnibus bill with a new approach. I welcome. This is not partisan. I think this is individual, and to the extent that this committee listens carefully to the testimony on these three bills and then has advice about where we go, and even today thoughts, I welcome it. So I just sort of position these three in that respect, and then we can proceed with the bills.
Representative Bradley, before we do that, it has just called to my attention that as a matter of form, we have not officially called the meeting to order. We now have a quorum, so we do call this meeting of the Health Committee officially to order. Wait, I'm sorry. That was kind of a... How's that?
That's more in character.
All right. Now, we'll go back to House File 2826, and it will be laid over for possible inclusion. Proceeding, Representative Samuelson is presenting House File 3481. I'll try to be more definitive with the mallet, Representative Abler.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. House File 3481, I would like to move that it is laid over, listened to, and laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
So moved. Please proceed.
Okay. There is a delete everything amendment so that I could get the bill in shape to present. So please look at that.
What's the, how's that identified, Representative Samuelson?
That is identified as H3481DE1.
34. Representative Samuelson moves the H3481DE1 delete all amendment to get the bill in the shape that she'd like. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, the amendment is adopted. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill deals with resident reimbursement classifications in nursing homes, the resident assessment schedule, alternate rates for nursing facilities, construction project adjustments, and the resident assessment schedule. It is a department bill, and I have two people here from the department that will go into more depth on the bill, and that's Greg Tabell and Val Cook.
Mr. Tabell, I see you're approaching, and Ms. Cook, welcome to the committee. Please proceed. And if you would, please, would you introduce yourself for the record?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Valerie Cook, and I work with the Department of Human Services, Nursing Facility Rates and Policy Division. I'll talk a little bit about the resident assessment schedule change that's proposed in this bill. What we're attempting to do here is to correct the unintended consequences when we designed the RUG case mix system back in 2002. What we're proposing to do here is to move to adopting all quarterly assessments when we establish the case mix payment system. And the idea here is to recognize residents' conditions that stabilize more quickly than the six-month period that currently, if you come, most residents are admitted from the hospital, and when they come in there, if they've had certain kinds of treatments or their condition in the hospital was less stable, they will typically stabilize in the nursing home within the first 45 to 90 days. So this change would then lower their case mix on the next quarterly assessment rather than being charged at higher payment rate for the full six-month period. And the method that we're proposing, as Representative Bradley talked about, there's various versions going being presented here today. And what we're proposing to do this is in a facility-specific, budget-neutral way so that there wouldn't be any impact on the revenue of each nursing facility. And so we would rebase the payment rates in this transition to cover any of the revenue losses that a nursing home would otherwise experience by making this change.
Thank you, Ms. Cook.
Mr. Chair, should we...
Representative Samuelson.
Should we ask for questions or wait till the testimony is complete?
There's no further testimony from Mr. Tabell. If you please introduce yourself.
Chair, he will continue through the bill.
I see what you're asking, Representative Samuelson. Why don't we hold questions till everybody's done with their testimony?
Thank you.
Please proceed, Mr. Tabell.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Greg Tabell. I am also from the Nursing Facility Rates and Policy Division. The remainder of this bill deals with construction projects for nursing facilities. Last year, the legislature made a provision that said all facilities that have been on the APS system, which is designed as a system to just give a rate plus inflation rather than do cost reports, it allowed those facilities to do construction projects of up to $1.2 million. The $1.2 million is a limit that is in statute. It's inflated annually. The exact amount is just slightly below 1.2 right now. But when this legislation was passed last year allowing these facilities to do these construction projects, we were looking through it and decided there's a lot of holes in here. It doesn't talk about how often you can do a project, how the rates are computed, how different limits apply. To use base year information from the last time the report cost. There's all sorts of things that we feel are just plain missing. In addition, a number of years ago, it was decided that those facilities under the contracts can do construction projects if they apply through the competitive process for more term exception dollars. It didn't say anything about how to compute rates then either. At the department, we had to devise a method to compute these rate adjustments. What we are asking in this bill is to put the methodology in statute, so it's there and it's showing how rates will be computed. There are currently two thresholds for construction projects. They're called the minimum and the maximum threshold. The 1.2 that I referred to earlier is the maximum. So you will see in here that it talks about the two different thresholds. You know, you got to attain these different dollar levels to be considered for a project. And then it also refers to how it's done, whether or not you're competing through the moratorium for those monies. The language really is very detailed. I was not planning on going through it here today with you, but we welcome any questions on it.
Thank you, Mr. Tabell. Representative Samuelson, unless you have something further, we'll open it up for questions.
That would be fine, Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. I see that Ms. Cullen, you're on the list to offer further insight.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Patty Cullen with Care Providers of Minnesota, speaking on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. You know, far be it from me for ever disagreeing with the department bill, but I'm going to do it for the first time here today. We do support the changes in the bill relating to the nursing facility building projects and want to make sure that that's on the record, that we review the language, and it's very complicated for people to look at, but it does follow through with what we thought needed to be done as well. So we wanted to make sure that was on the record. Secondly, we do not support the proposal just to move to the quarterly assessments without also addressing the case mix weights. And there's several bits of concern that we have with it, but I think what I will do is wait for most of my comments when the third case mix bill is up here and we can talk about why we think both things need to be done simultaneously, both moving to the quarterly assessments and moving to the updated weights based on the time study. The only comment I would give, though, is to make sure legislators know that when it says facility-specific budget-neutral rebasing, that doesn't mean that some facilities won't be negatively affected. What it means is when you do the crosswalk to the point in time where you're saying it's budget-neutral, it's only budget-neutral at that snapshot point in time. So that if a facility changed its services or decided to establish a subacute wing to take care of the folks that come from the hospitals and to a greater degree, that if they did that after this point in time that they're being measured and the weights have gone down, there could be some negative repercussions there. So I want to make sure that you're aware that just because it says budget neutral on a facility-specific basis, to have that happen, you have to match up people, and because we have residents moving in and out of facilities all the time, it's virtually impossible to have a seamless transition when you do that. And we found that out when we moved from, for people who were around when we moved from the case mix system to the RUG system back in, I think, 2002, you had that effect, and you had some facilities come before this committee saying, wait a minute, I was caught in the middle. So we just want to make sure people are aware of that. And I'll save the rest of my comments, I think, for one of the other case mix bills.
Thank you, Ms. Cullen. Before we go to questions or further comment by Representative Samuelson, I have been told we need to welcome the ninth grade students from St. Louis Park High School. Welcome to the Health Policy Committee. That was resounding. Representative Samuelson, anything further, or if not, we're going to open it up to questions from members. You ready?
Mr. Chair, I do not have anything further at this point to
discuss. All right. Questions from members? Seeing none, Representative Samuelson renews her motion that it be held over for possible inclusion, and the chair will hold House File 3481 over possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
That'd be as amended.
As amended. Thanks for your help.
Thank you.
Next, we have House File 2933, Representative Bradley.
This whole thing is that portable.
And Representative Bradley, I believe the first order of business you have, obviously after you move the bill.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I would move the bill for consideration.
All right.
And then, Mr. Chair, I believe that, I don't have the right folder here with me. I believe that there's an amendment.
The A1 amendment?
A1 amendment. I move that. I think that's, excuse me, that's largely just technical in nature, change an or to and. And then the dates, I welcome the opportunity to be able to move up, and it was suggested to me, I believe, by the department that we could achieve that earlier, so just move it up to the 2006 time frame.
All right. Members, does everyone have the A1 amendment before them? Any questions on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, the author moves the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape that he desires. All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed? The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Bradley, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe this is the bill that industry wanted to have passed. Probably not. Let me be more straight on this. This bill took a simplistic approach. I thought, and I want you to hear Ms. Horlocker's case because it's probably a case that many of you heard as well. But just to sort of put it in the proper context, this would adopt the quarterly case mix, which you heard that discussion before, and that's it. And I think from an industry point of view, what that means, of course, is, and I don't have the numbers exactly in front of me, but that would mean an impact, of course, on nursing home revenues, and in some cases could be fairly significant. I'm sympathetic to that, but I think this is just a way to get the discussion before us. But that's what the bill is, a very simple that we would use. Today it's every 6 months. This would kick in the first and third assessment, so it would be every quarter that the case mix assessment would actually be used to determine rates for people. And, Mr. Chair, with that, I would like to introduce Ms. Pat Horlocker, and I think she could relate to you kind of a real person impact of our current system.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Horlocker. Will you please introduce yourself for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Pat Horlocker. I'm a resident of Rochester, Minnesota. And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to come before you today to tell the story, our family story, of what happened with the case mix review. My mother is a 98-year-old resident of a nursing home in Rochester. Last spring, she was in an assisted living facility and made the decision herself, as a 97-year-old then, to move to the nursing home. She was required to be seen by a male physician, which she did, and during that consultation, he recommended an evaluation for physical therapy. She moved into the nursing home on May 5th. On May 6th of 2005, she started physical therapy. That lasted for 2 weeks, and at the end of the 2 weeks, she was told that she no longer needed any more physical therapy. In other words, she had graduated. During that time, she was assessed for her daily needs in the nursing home. When we had met with the social worker prior to her coming in, she had estimated that her daily rate would be $116 per day. As a result of being in physical therapy, that raised her daily rate $31.10 a day to $147. It was after this that we were told that she would have to pay that rate, and she's a private pay resident, pay that rate for 6 months because of the state regulations. We did go through the appeal process, and it was denied, specifically because the nursing home had followed all the rules and regulations. We have talked with just about everybody at the nursing home, the administrator, the social worker, the nurses, everybody. And we've talked with legislators, people in the health department, including case mix review, and we're told by each of them that there was nothing that they could do. Those are the rules. Those are the regulations. Excuse me. No one had the authority to look at her case and make a decision on this individual case. she had to wait until the end of the 6 months to be reevaluated. And by the way, when that did happen, her daily rate was back to the PA1 or the $116 a day at that time. Another factor, in the nursing home, the first month, a resident pays what they call the enhanced rate, or 120% of the monthly fee. And in her case, because she was being assessed $31.10 a day higher than originally estimated, we ended up paying for her $1,120 more than she would have at the lower rate. And of course, we thought that paid for her physical therapy. And a few months later, we find out that Medicare paid $963.37 to the nursing home for her physical therapy, and her supplemental insurance later paid $240.85 to the nursing home for a total of $1,204.22. And of course, I've written to all our representatives and governor and attorney general, everybody I can think of. We're looking for some sort of relief to the situation, and we could not find it. And during this time, we paid the lower rate. We paid the first month in full and then paid the lower rate, as I say, while we were looking for some relief. At the end of the 6 month, when they reassessed her, as I said, it was down to the lower rate. And at that point, we received a threatening letter from the nursing home that they were going to start discharge papers for lack of payment of bill. Now, this adds up to over about $4,800 of her private money, of her savings. She has a small income from our farm and from her savings, and that is it. But she was asked to pay $4,800 for nothing over this six-month period, actually five-month period. We feel that there should be some way, some person, somebody who could look at a situation like this on an individual basis and make a fair judgment, a compassionate judgment, and say this isn't right.
Thank you, Ms. Horlock.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Unless you have something further, Representative Bradley?
We've had a lot of chance to have discussions along the way, and Mr. Chair, just to add a couple of other dimensions to this, because I mean, you can understand why Ms. Horlocker and her family are frustrated. And by the way, as I said, I suspect that that's around this table and around state that it's happened in some form or another. The other part that's not in any of these bills that you may have sort of heard a little bit about that intrigues me, and I don't have a solution yet, is to have an appeals process. And I can't fault, I mean, the people that did it today did it by the current rules in terms of the appeals process. There's two kinds of different appeals. One appeal is whether or not the initial assessment's done properly. And I think in returning that result, even Ms. Horlocker would say the initial assessment was probably right. That was the condition. However, a few weeks later, the care for this person is different. There is another form of appeals process that I learned about. However, it has some very stringent requirements in it, and it has, I believe, if I remember right, that you have to have three significant changes, and they're sort of laid out in rule. And it's very, very hard to meet that standard. Very hard. Because if there were a way that you could have a circumstance like this that could be treated from what I think would be a common sense analysis, that might be an alternative, or maybe a complement to the quarterly, because the quarterly doesn't fix everything. It just means at least you don't pay $4,800, you pay something less than that in terms of extra expense. Now, of course, the counter argument that you hear is there are cases also from the industry's point of view where people go the other way, where people's needs grow and the nursing home doesn't get a chance to catch up on the cost of those until later too. I don't think any of us are impractical enough to think that we could have day-by-day-by-day kind of analyses. I do think, and as I said, I don't really have a good answer, that as a complement to the more frequent analysis that Bartman says is not that hard to implement, which I think that part, if we can figure out how we treat fairly the industry, it makes sense. But I think there's another ingredient that sort of begs for a better analysis, and that's, is there a better appeals approach? If you if you took a case like Ms. Horlocker talked about, it seems like, at least when I looked at it, I thought, you know what, I don't understand why we wouldn't change the rate being charged. So I just laid that on the table. Sometimes when you get into issues, there's more dimensions. We are focused today primarily on the quarterly assessment, but I would argue in some respects that that's a partial solution and that maybe we need somewhere along the way to analyze as well the appeals process. Thank you, Representative Bradley. Questions from members? Representative Thiessen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this all tied to the fact that our rates are equalized?
Representative Bradley. If they weren't equalized, we'd probably not be here.
That's
not true. No, it's not. I'm sorry. I don't mean to keep it. In answer to your question, in fairness, I don't think that this has anything to do with rate equalization.
Well, Mr. Chair, just in this example, it sounds like your mother had physical therapy and then at some point didn't.
It was after 2 weeks. She was
right.
2 weeks.
And my dad is actually in the same spot right now, but thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry.
I'm all about formality. Representative Thiessen.
So I get, and I probably it's because I don't know enough about case mix and why, but so the state is actually telling nursing homes we have a law that they can only change it every 6 months, even though the nursing home is going to know that the physical therapy disappeared after 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And so how do we get to this point to begin with? I guess question.
You know what, and rethinking the question about equalization if it were gone, I don't know that I've sort of thought that carefully about the whole freedom that occurs in private pay. Perhaps there could be a model in the private pay that could be more responsive, because in theory, you're going to charge what you believe is the market's going to allow you to charge. And on the private pay, I'm not sure if there's anybody behind me that can answer this, but perhaps there would be, for the private pay, the option to react more quickly. Because I think they would get out of our business in some respects. You may be onto something there. I don't know if there's anybody that can respond to that.
Yes. Ms. Cullen was nodding her head.
Oh, excellent observation, Representative Thiessen. I think... I should have thought more thoughtfully about it, but I think that's right. I think if it were gone, we wouldn't have this discussion. Mm-hmm. Now, it might be another. I mean, you know, they might argue with the nursing home, but then it's a free market, and you can say, fine, I'll go someplace where I do something different.
May I add one more thing, please?
Ms. Horner.
The letter was received regarding starting discharge papers for non-payment of bill. In talking with Mom, she decided rather than be disrupted with another move, we are paying on that bill. We are paying on the $4,800 for nothing, but we're paying in installments on it. And by the way, her care has not changed since she moved into the nursing home. So,
thank you, Ms. Horlocker.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Representative Bradley, any further clarification?
I'm sorry. Why do I get into these things that get more complicated with everything I hear? There is another. I'll come back to the point, but just on this, I'm told that sort of there's another that we're not going to pay in medical assistance less. Let's see.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, more than a private pay. So if you had a circumstance where the private pay patient, if they were on medical assistance, would be actually costing less, which I mean, in this case could be. Theoretically possible, that might not be allowed. Now, if there's a differential enough that you don't bump into that, then maybe it wouldn't. So it's a little more complicated than I originally said, but I think there may be a pony in that. Now, I'm sorry, back to the other point that was raised. Do you have a question for me?
I don't think there was, Representative Bradley. I think you've just addressed it. Further questions? Seeing none, the chair will hold House File 2933 as amended over for possible inclusion. Next, we have House File 3153, Representative Finstad. The Honorable Representative Finstad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I make the motion at this time that we lay over House File 3153 for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Finance Omnibus Bill.
So moved.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. because I am just a dumb farm kid from Sleepy Eye, I'll keep this quick and we'll turn it over to the experts in the field to talk about what I see as, and this is probably obvious because I'm carrying this bill, but I think this leads more to the direction of where Representative Bradley and Representative Samuelson were going with their bills, and I think this is the Cadillac version. With that being said, I'll quickly give you the bullet point.
Representative Finstead, please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've had the opportunity to hear from the rest, and I will listen to the best. So.
Mr. Chair, can you comment?
Representative Tisa?
It's interesting that I've not ever seen that side of the aisle arguing over who is offering the Cadillac version of a health care program.
Well, you haven't seen the tires yet. Please continue.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. In all seriousness, I have just a quick rundown of bullet points that I have made regarding this bill, and then I'll turn it over to Ms. Patty Cohen for the details of this proposal. But this bill, in a quick summary, essentially does this. It establishes quarterly case mix assessments for residents. It modifies case mix indices, and it provides a rate adjustment for facilities that have a decrease in revenue under this change. And furthermore, it establishes new case mix assessment indices to better identify a resident's rate for care. And that is very quick, very bullet point, but I will turn it over to Ms. Cullen for the details.
Thank you. Ms. Cullen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Patty Cullen, Care Providers in Minnesota, speaking on behalf of Long-Term Care Imperative. I'd like to think this more of a Saturn kind of perspective rather than a Cadillac. We have currently over 300 different rates that you could get if you entered a nursing facility. There's 34 RUGS categories times single bedroom times double bedroom times first 30 day times. So it's a wonder that there may be a little bit of confusion out there on what rate do I get. And so when we're going to do changes to the case mix system, the implication for each individual resident and their families and nursing facilities currently living there means that we have to explain all over again why they pay this. We have to change our software systems because we have software that ties into the minimum data set, which is the resident assessment, and some trigger payments and some don't. So just moving to a quarterly assessment, we'll have a software fiscal note and we'll have an information fiscal note in terms of administrative costs. So if you're just going to do that without fixing the underlying weights behind it and rebalancing what I refer to in a nursing facility rates, that's why we have a concern with just doing the Chevy rather than a Saturn model here. Because the state did invest serious amount of money in doing a time study to update the weights for the case mix categories. This was passed, I believe, in 2002, and in 2003, the largest nursing facility time study ever undertaken in a single state was done in this state. We had nearly 3,000 residents assessed on 66 nursing units, 45 nursing facilities. We had staff that had one of those little time study handheld machines to say, it takes this much time to do this. The end result is there was a report that was done in July 2004 that said, you know what, the weights aren't right. You're correct. Things that you may have heard from your constituents for years actually came true. It does take more time to take care of people with dementia. It does take more time to try to get the cares done on individuals that have challenging behaviors. We said that for years, and now we have a time study that proved it. The old case mix system that was converted in 2002 to the Medicare RUG system was not based on a staff time study that looked at behavioral. It was based on a hospital time study on certain clinical conditions. Even though we have 34 RUGS categories and up to 300 different rates, individual constituents look at that rates on an individual basis saying, I'm paying $116 for my loved one. facilities have to look at that as a balance. They're being underpaid for their behavioral folks. They may be overpaid for some of their clinical people from the hospitals. That's what the Time study said. But overall, they need enough money to pay their bills. That's why we think it's important to do both things. When the DHS negotiating committee was meeting over the last few years, we did talk about the issue of case mix, and we did say it makes sense to go to quarterlies for the reasons that the prior bills talked to, even though for some facilities it means they're going to get less income than they currently do today for some of their people returning from hospitals. They're balancing the costs for the underpaid categories of case mix on getting more money for those returned to the hospital. But you're right, on an individual constituent basis, that's not fair that someone in room 62A is paying for 12 people on the second floor unit because they're being underpaid. So going to quarterly assessments does make sense. I do want to do a comment on the significant change data. That is a federal law to do assessments on significant change. Last week we met with a group of our directors of nursing and we talked about the issue of why is it the significant change catching some of this, as Representative Bradley alluded to. And they believe it is, that there's been a big change in the number of significant change assessments being done. We asked the health department for data last week. We don't have it yet. So I'm hoping by next week, Representative Bradley, that I could have additional data on is the significant change working better than it has in the past, because that's what we're hearing anecdotally, and that's an aside. So we do have an opportunity to do both. Now, because we've been underpaying more of the weights than we've been overpaying on an individual basis, there's a cost to this. And I think you have a fifth note in your packet that we're going to convert to the weights that recognize the staff time needed based on the time study that was done, it is going to cost more. There's greater rates to facilities, and historically when we looked at this, we said, well, right now the law says we should be implementing those weights on a facility-specific budget-neutral basis. But that makes no sense, because in order to do that, you'd increase the weights for those facilities that specialize in dementia care, but to make it budget-neutral, you'd have to cut their rates. So they would get no more. They would just have higher weights but a lower multiplier. So we were not supportive of implementing the new weights on a budget-neutral basis, because it really doesn't give help to those facilities that have said they need the greatest help. And again, it's primarily the lower case mix categories of the 34 RUGS categories at the bottom half. Our analysis shows that there will be about 80% of the facilities and the residents will see a benefit. 80% of the facilities will see a benefit with this bill. There's about 20% that either lose a little bit or lose a little bit more than a little bit because of the higher clinical being reassessed. We have to balance that out with the fact that many of the folks coming from hospitals get Medicare their first days. Medicare pays for most of that if it's a three-day hospitalization and it's intense clinical. More than you need to know, or want to know, I suppose. But we also have put in this bill a hold harmless so that we don't have facilities that all of a sudden are stopping the specializations. They establish either subacute units or dementia units for a reason. It was addressing a need in the marketplace, and we don't want to discourage innovations or the development of specialized units to meet a need, nor do we want to create any additional access issues. One of the ongoing dilemmas that many of our members have is the placement of individuals with behavior problems with significant mental health needs that still need nursing facility care. The facilities that most recently closed in the Twin Cities area were facilities that specialized in that treatment. They're heavily Medicaid populated, very little Medicare dollars, and the lower case mix weight. And so financially they struggled and they have closed. We're concerned there's going to be an access issue that's going to bubble up through the mental health system, and that there's going to be continued calls from hospitals about folks backed up that really should be cared for in some of our nursing facilities but for the payment. So that's a long-winded explanation on why we think both need to be done. There was a group of stakeholders that looked at these issues in the interim, and we recommended that both be done at the same time. We understand the department has an issue with bringing forward something that has a fiscal note, but the remaining, and matter of fact, one of the stakeholder groups will comment about the work that we did in taking a look at all the data and the analysis, but that's why we believe it's important to address both issues. Let's pay the right weights and at the right timing for case mix. And if you'd like further descriptions of all 328 of the different potential rates, I could certainly get into that as well.
Thank you, Ms. Cullen. Representative Finstead? Where is it? Welcome, ma'am. Will you please introduce yourself?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jane Okramovich, and I'm a volunteer with the Alzheimer's Association. I'm also the current chair of one of the stakeholder groups that Kathy mentioned, Seniors and Workers for Quality. Although case mix weights may not be the jazziest term that you'd like to be talking about right now or issue in long-term care, the consumers and the workers have long realized that nursing home reimbursement for behavioral care is insufficient. Our coalition supported and also promoted the time study that 5 years ago that Patty mentioned, and we fully support implementing its recommendations now. This bill promises a second value to consumers in the quarterly assessments so that their payments can be more quickly adjusted to reflect their actual needs. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Okramovich.
Very nice. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Finstead, anything further? Otherwise, we'll open it up for questions.
At this point, we'll be ready for questions, Mr. Chair.
Questions from members. Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Cullen, initially when I got into this on the quarterly assessment, intuitively I'd have thought, well, it should balance. We ought to hit about as many that are underpaying as are overpaying. And yet, you know, apparently there is an impact. Can you explain to me why there's not a balance both ways? I mean, because there are plenty of patients that require more service in between the 6 months.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bradley, there is, if you look at the individual facility effects of the change to the case mix and moving to quarterlies, it varies depending upon the services. We have some facilities that are, I would call, feeder facilities from the hospitals for certain services. In the clinical arena, they specialize in subacute care, they specialize in rehab. And there are some that have very little. We have some facilities that aren't even Medicare certified. And Medicare generally pays. The fiscal impact is always jaded because of the Medicare, because Medicare generally pays for, you know, the first 20 days at 100% and then the remaining 80 days with a co-payment amount. So if you have a three-day prior hospitalization, and now under MSHR you don't even need that, and if you have a condition that requires skilled nursing, Medicare will be the first payer. So the effects on, and the majority of the people, I mean, over 95% of individuals in nursing facilities would qualify if they're over 65 for Medicare. There's only a handful that may have already used their days. So I think some of the differences that we've seen in the analysis depend on what's their specialization, do they have rehab therapy in the facility, do they even have Medicare certification, and if they have specialization in dementia care and they have longer lengths of stay, you'll see a whole different effect on that. Did I answer your question?
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I may need a little follow-up. I mean, we get fiscal notes that show what things might cost the taxpayer, but we don't get fiscal notes really that assess kind of the industry impact. So if you could follow up details, it's still not quite clear to me. I mean, one could sort of argue, absent, I understand the discussion you're having about our current rate system isn't fair in its own respect, and you're trying to do something about that. But on the issue of fairness to residents, and for that matter, I thought even fairness to nursing homes, it would have seemed like a more frequent assessment does nothing more than just keep us better in tune. I mean, that's all it is. It's not creating something new. It's not creating a new rate system or anything. All it's doing is making sure that we're more up to speed. And that sounds, on its surface, as being pretty fair. So what's wrong with just doing it more often and being more up to speed?
Ms. Cullen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bradley, when we converted to the RUG system back in 2002 because we were doing two assessments on everyone, one that was a state-based system and one was federal, and we decided, let's get rid of some of that paperwork, and that was a positive thing. But one of the things that happened in the conversion is that under the old case mix system, there were a lot of J's. We were getting credit. We were getting additional weight for certain categories of individuals based on neurological diagnosis. And when that was eliminated because they didn't have that kind of category into the Medicare system, we almost had a trade-off. It was a balance. You're not going to get paid for these people, but we'll pay you for these people. And the balance and the conversion looked at how much you're going to get paid over 6 months for these conditions, recognizing that it's true that people who come back from the hospital under certain categories, generally within 45 days, I think that's the average, their condition improves. We had argued at that time that it's a balance. It's a balance between what we're no longer getting paid for in the weights under the old system and what we'll be paid for under the new system. But as I mentioned earlier, on an individual constituent basis who doesn't know the history and doesn't know that, you know, they may be subsidizing someone else, you're right, that doesn't seem fair. But on average, those facilities that did the conversion that specialized in certain types of neurological disorders that now had to convert to a RUG system that doesn't pay it, that was a trade-off we had at the time. As we've looked at, and matter of fact, in the testimony, when the system was converted, we said, you know what, there's going to be X number of people, a very small percentage, they're going to be paying a lot more for their services with this conversion. And we all said, yep, we know that that's going to happen, but the pros far outweighed the cons for that small group of people when the Medicare dollar runs out. So one of the issues we have now is that it's only a few years later. We haven't had enough balance in this, and now we're looking at another change that affects that. So there, it doesn't balance out on a facility basis as easily as one would think, because those six-month periods from individual residents are actually subsidizing someone who isn't getting paid for now.
Thank you. Further questions? Seeing none, the chair will hold over House File 3153 for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Finstein. Next, we're going to hear House File 3208, the Honorable Representative Dean Erdahl.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
I'll move the bill.
Representative Abler moves House File 3208 for...
to the consent calendar, Mr. Chair.
I believe that was misspoken.
The possible inclusion of possible finance. So.
Thank you.
You will put it on the consent calendar.
It hasn't worked for you to date, so you might as well come up with something new. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We appreciate the opportunity to bring this issue before you today. Our day training program and rehabilitation facility in Litchfield is in trouble. Consistent with my belief that government must help those that cannot help themselves, I'm here to urge your consideration of House File 3208, which provides ProWorks in Litchfield with an 8% rate increase. Now, because I'm just an old retired school teacher from Grove City, I'll let the director of ProWorks, Mr. Dale Miller, present his position.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Miller. Will you please introduce yourself and proceed?
Yes, my name is Dale Miller. I'm the director of ProWorks in Litchfield, Minnesota. And as Representative Erdahl said, ProWorks is a day training rehabilitation provider. We provide a day program to people with mental retardation, traumatic brain injury, and other mental health issues. Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, committee members. Appreciate the opportunity to speak with you. What's being passed out right now is what will appear in our local paper. The last week, some of this information or information concerning our situation did appear in the paper from the Meeker County Community Board, Meeker County Board of Commissioners, and it then got into paper. So I felt the need to then respond to the community and let them know, and not that that information was incorrect, but I felt that the public had a right to know further what was actually happening to our agency and how we got to that point. And I think what I'll do is just, I'm just going to follow right down here. It's very simple, very basic, and then you know, if you have any questions on anything at all, please feel free to ask. Day training rehabilitation providers in Minnesota, there's a wide range of per diem rates. There are 252 licensed programs, and the rates vary from $40 a day up to $140 a day. our rate is $60.75. We've always been one of the lowest in the state of Minnesota. And that had been fine, you know, up until just a few years ago when we were asked to take a 1% decrease. And then the following year, we received no increase at all. And last year, then we received a 2.2553% increase on October 1st. And most of that revenue generated by that increase will go to provide increased wages and benefits to my employees, to all employees, plus the office staff and the administrator. And our situation, we're kind of stuck. We just kind of got hit by the perfect storm, I guess, where, you know, things happening at the state. The next paragraph tells a little bit about our work comp premium has jumped dramatically from just under $7,000 in 2001 up to better than $43,000 in 2006. And for a small agency, that, of course, is very difficult to absorb. We put on about 200,000 miles each year, transporting people to and from our programs and to and from work sites and job sites and what have you. And our vehicles are old. When we met with Senator Dill and Representative Erdahl, this incident just happened, but I shared a picture with them that one of my vehicles, I had a client nearly fall through the back of the vehicle. The only thing that was actually holding her in was the rubber matting. And I did not realize that it was in that bad of shape, but we hadn't updated vehicles for quite some time, and obviously we need to do so, but cannot afford to do so. Finally, within Meeker County is a very conservative county, and I've been telling them for many years that we simply need more homes built in the county. My program has grown to serve 77 people, but in many cases I've had to, or persons I've served, their family situation or what have you has changed, so they've had to find another place to live. And in many cases, they were not able to find a home in Meeker County. So that's impacted my budget drastically as well. And like I say, this is kind of the perfect storm. Just a lot of different things hit us at one time, and it's kind of come to the culmination of this. Closure of this program that has been in existence for 30 years. We celebrated our 30-year anniversary last year. I've been with the program for 25 years. And of course, I've seen the ups and downs, but never to this extent, of course. It's pretty serious at this point. But anyway, I've made Meeker County aware of the situation starting way back in December of 2003. The process that I have to receive a rate variance is that I go to Meeker County, they approve a rate increase, and then they go on to then the increase, if it's approved at the county level, goes on to the state of Minnesota. And each time that I've gone in to Meeker County for the rate increase, I've been told that they are over-authorized in the mental retardation-related conditions waiver money that they receive from the state. And from Annette Hasenstab, trying to explain why this is occurring, is that she says in the legislature 2003 and 2005, those MRRC waiver dollars were kept neutral. And, you know, I don't know. I feel like my program is kind of stuck between county and state and everybody else with the rising cost of providing services. And we are to a point, however, where we have about 70,000 left in reserves. We are transferring between 5,000 and 8,000 out of those reserves every pay period. That's every 2 weeks. And obviously with that, once the reserves are gone, we're gone. I've impressed upon Meeker County that one way or another, this is going to cost more, whether they approve a rate variance for ProWorks, or whether they, if we go under, what they will have to do is send out a request for proposal for a new day training rehabilitation provider to come into Meeker County. And, you know, if a program that has been there for 30 years is not making that $60.75 a day, I doubt that any other program would as well. So anyway, that's my story, I guess, if you have questions.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Before we do that, is there anyone else here that would like to testify in regard to House File 3208? Seeing no one, questions for the author or for Mr. Miller? Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've heard that there are, let's say, individual pockets by counties that problems are more critical. And some of what I've heard has been not just about rates, but also about actual placements and about the county, because the county has some stake in this as well in terms of county funds that have been typically used. Can you comment, to what extent is your program supported by county dollars, and how's your actual utilization going with the county behind that as far as referrals?
Mr. Miller.
I can't tell you the breakdown as far as county dollars involved. I don't know what kind of a match there is to. I know that the mental retardation related conditions waiver is a federal program. I know there's a lot of state dollars involved as well. And I'm not sure, but I think there might be some county dollars in there as well. And the other form of funding that we have is the CSSA, Community Children's and Services Act. And there I also believe that there's some county dollars, but I believe it's a small portion. But I think what they're actually saying, the problem is that, you know, they receive this allocation of funding from the state of Minnesota. But what MECA does is they pool their money with McLeod County and Renville County, and they call it the Warm Alliance, W-A-R-M-M. And so then from there they buy, you know, a whole myriad of MRRC waiver services, and there's about, you know, maybe 20 services available to individuals. And what happens is that at the beginning of the year, case managers authorize service to, you know, it's kind of a protection for themselves and for the individual, but they authorize many, many services, and they're not always provided. And so those dollars that are not provided then just remain in the pool. But as I understand it, the pool is, you know, that they keep telling me they don't have the money to do it. And, you know, I don't know if that's true or not. I do know that with day training rehabilitation providers, unlike residential providers, and I'm not saying that they're doing well either, but I did want to just mention that we're paid on, based on actual days of service. So on Monday, when we were closed, we lost $4,000. And through the month of January, we lost the homes that we work with. They will often make appointments, dentist appointments, medical appointments, stuff throughout the day, and every now and then we have to send a memo out and say, hey, you got to stop doing that. You'll schedule after hours. But anyway, my point being is that in January, because of medical appointments too, my program was not able to bill for $4,900. So, I mean, we're kind of getting hit every time we turn around here, and it's making it very difficult to keep the doors open.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Any further questions? Representative Abler.
Mr. Chair, and maybe you know, or the department might know, if the place closes, what would the rate of the new provider be? I don't think it would be $60 and whatever. I think they'd come in at a different rate. And so does somebody know what the new rate would be? Is the department here? Is there,
Mr.
Do you know what it would be?
If that really, you know, that really isn't known, because Napier County would put out a request for proposal, and, you know, perhaps providers from neighboring counties would they put the proposal in saying, you know, we can do it for this rate, and then Meeker County would have the option of accepting that rate or not. So it could be anywhere. I mean, there's no set rate right now that a new provider would be able to come in at.
Mr. Chair, as I understand this, I think that these rates are all over the map, and here's a low-rate provider who's about to drop off the bottom. And I don't know, but I know that in Elkhart County we had a provider, and they've become prisoners of history, and not based upon even all their. So it's just the point is that it may well be that if they go out of business and a new provider comes in, it may actually cost more money to do what they're doing, even counting their bill. So I know it's a challenge for funds, and this is a tip of the iceberg. There's a lot of providers like this, and we have tried. It should be important to know that the House, in particular, has been trying hard to keep the rates funding level as it is, and we've gone through some terrible lean times. And it's been the House, on a bipartisan basis, that has decided that we're going to look after these folks. And the reason we only got a 1% nick instead of 4 is because of the House and Chair Bradley in particular.
Yeah, I know.
We love that way. So, but we're still very challenged in some of these, and these are very important services. So, maybe somebody can find out for me, I don't know, what if they fold and they provide those services, how they go about establishing a rate. Does anybody know here who's here, Mr. Chair?
Representative Abler, Mr. Chen, would you have that?
Mr. Chair and members, I think that the rate would have to be negotiated with county.
Thank you.
And I would gamble it would be higher than $60 and 90 cents. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Abler. Any further questions or comments?
Just thank you very much. I appreciate your attention to this very important matter.
Thank you for all your input, Representative Rudolph. With that, the chair will hold over House File 3208 for possible inclusion.
Thank you.
How's that? Next, we have House File 3315, Representative Samuelson.
Looks like you know what you're doing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Please proceed, Representative Samuelson.
Okay. I would like to move the House File 3315 be passed and laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
So moved.
Thank you. House File 3315 actually talks about the life safety code in nursing homes. And there has been a great increase in nursing homes being tagged for not having sprinkler installations. And what we're asking for today is actually to be able to install sprinkler systems in the nursing homes without having to qualify for the $231,000 minimum that the alternative payment system dictates or designates. And I have Lori Meyer here with me, and she will talk a little bit more about the details.
Thank you. Welcome, Ms. Meyer. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Good morning. My name is Lori Meyer. I'm with the Minnesota Health and Housing Alliance, the other half of the Long-Term Care Imperative. Nursing facilities, as you all know, are subject to a wide variety of regulations, and one of the most important of these is adherence to the Life Safety Code. The Life Safety Code establishes standards for physical plans and procedures to ensure a safe environment for nursing facility residents. Unfortunately, in 2003, there were two fires, not in Minnesota, but elsewhere, that occurred in nursing facilities, and that caused a reaction from CMS to do two things. The first was in 2003, they promulgated rules that requires nursing facilities to comply with the 2000 Life Safety Code. Previously, facilities would be forced to adhere to whatever Life Safety Code was in effect at the time that their building was constructed or remodeled, and now all facilities have to comply with the higher standard in the 2000 code. The other change that CMS implemented was a more vigorous enforcement of the code itself, and this involved federal monitoring surveys where the feds would come in after a state agency survey or fire marshal survey and conduct their own assessment. Now, needless to say, all of this activity has resulted in a huge increase in the number of Life Safety Code deficiencies that have been cited. And these deficiencies are called K-tags. Just to give you a sense of the increase, prior to 2005, the number of K-tags that the average facility would receive for Life Safety Code is one or two. Now, in 2005, for the federal monitoring surveys, the K-tags were averaging between 15 and 20, and the state fire marshal surveys are coming in at close to 10 K-tags. So I don't want to shock anyone here, but my testimony is not to request or advocate for a relaxation of these standards. Quite the contrary, we think that providing safe environments for our frail elderly to minimize the risk of fires or other hazardous events in nursing facilities is extremely important. What we're requesting in House File 3315 is that we need a little flexibility in the payment mechanism that reimburses facilities for capital projects so that providers can be in compliance with the Life Safety Code. Currently, the payment system establishes two thresholds, an upper threshold at about $1.1 million and a lower threshold at about $231,000. And the system does reimburse for projects that fall between those two thresholds. What we did is we surveyed our members, and it turns out that to get into compliance with the Life Safety Code surveys, the average cost is around $50,000. So all of these corrections and compliance activities are coming in under the lower threshold, therefore they are not being reimbursed. Now, fewer facilities are in a financial position to go ahead and make these corrections without reimbursement, and so what some facilities have done is they will add to their project to increase the cost bump it up over that $231,000 lower threshold and therefore get the reimbursement for it. That's not necessarily the most efficient way to go about correcting physical plant issues. So we would encourage your support of House File 3315, that will create some flexibility on that lower threshold specifically for projects that would either partially or fully sprinkle our facilities or to get into compliance with the life safety code. And I would stand for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Meyer. Why don't we hold the questions until after Mr. Vossen has finished testifying. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Vossen. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Jim Vossen. I'm with the United Food and Commercial Workers, Local 653, and I'm an active member of the Workers and Seniors and Workers for Quality. On behalf of the people I represent in our coalition, I speak in support of House File 3315. It should go without saying, so this will be really short, that these fundamental elements of a safe residence and workplace are vital. It is unfortunate that we continue to address reimbursement issues piecemeal rather than a sweeping reform that benefits the people who live and work in nursing homes. But given our realities, let's make this one piece of progress this session. So I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Vossen. At this point, are there any others in the room that would like to testify to House File 3315? Seeing none, any questions from members for the author or the testifiers? Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, first of all, just the fiscal impact in this biennium is $202,000. Is that, am I reading the right one for this bill? That's correct? Okay. And then, Mr. Chair, I'll just make a comment. I don't think it's anybody that would question where we want to truly protect the safety of the people who work and the people who live. However, having been around many places around Minnesota, some of these so-called life standards things are very questionable. And at least for the record, when you require sprinklers on a canopy over the outside, when, I mean, I'm sorry, but common sense would say, what a waste, really. I just, not every bit of it makes sense to me. So, whatever it's worth.
Thank you, Representative Bradley. Ms. Meyer, did you have a comment?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Bradley. I completely agree. I think one of the ones we often use in our conversations is the requirement of the sprinkler and the freezer. Unfortunately, it is a mandated federal requirement that facilities must address.
Now, we've had a lot of those fires in those freezers.
Sounds like good government. Thank you, Ms. Meyer. Representative Abler.
Just a short, this change in the standards, is that all federal, and were you aware of it coming, or is this the post time?
Ms. Meyer.
Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, yes, it is a change at the federal level, and we did have some anticipation that it was coming. Certainly, we were surprised at the level of deficiencies that have increased in the past year.
Thank you, Ms. Meyer. For the questions, Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a question about the bill with life safety issues. It says sprinkler systems or compliance with life safety code standards. How expansive would that be in terms of life safety issues there are, and would this have to be flagged by a local building official for you to apply for this, or is there anything that says that, for example, screens on windows could be a life safety issue to keep insects out? Could this turn into a window project and lots of other things like that?
Ms. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and Representative Dean. The Life Safety Code is quite precise in what it is requiring of nursing facilities, and their standards that are primarily at the federal level. So I don't think that there's a lot of interpretation flexibility in terms of other projects that facilities might want to do and say that it is in response to a Life Safety Code issue. I think the code is pretty clear.
Thank you. I've just had had the experience of having to prepare buildings for final inspection, and elevator rooms are required to be sprinkled by the fire inspector, but the elevator inspector mandates that there are no sprinklers in the elevator room. So you got to really coordinate those two inspections. So, for what that's worth, I understand where this is coming from.
Thank you, Representative Dean. Is there something further, Ms. Meyer?
Well, I just wanted to make sure that it was clear in the bill the reason why the language that Representative Dean cited says sprinklers or life safety code compliance is because currently sprinkling is not a requirement of the life safety code. We do feel, however, that it is so important to ensure the safety of residents. We did include that as well.
Thank you, Ms. Meyer. Seeing no further questions, the chair will hold over House File 3315 for possible inclusion. Thank you. Next up, we have House File 3314. Representative Samuelson, please move your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move House File 3314 to lay over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you. So moved. Please proceed.
Thank you. And House File 3314 really talks about a temporary increase in the payment rate to nursing homes because of the energy-related issues that the nursing homes ran across this year. What this would be is a $2 per patient per day increase, and it would be implemented on October 1st of this year, and it would be through December 31st of this year. I'm sorry, there's an error here on my copy. Be through December 31st of 2006. And there again, Lori Meyer is here to discuss the bill.
Okay. Thank you. Welcome again, Ms. Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, I'm Lori Meyer with the Minnesota Health and Housing Alliance. And just to underscore what Representative Samuelson described, the bill is temporary. The rate adjustment is $2. It would only be in effect for 3 months. I will just, in the interest of time, say that for nursing facilities, again, with regulations, they are required to maintain a temperature of 71 to 81 degrees for the comfort of the residents. And so it is not a situation where facilities could adjust to heating increases by turning down the thermostat, something that you and I probably have done to deal with the cost increases this season. The other thing I would point out is in the discussion about equalization earlier today, if there wasn't equalization, there would be an opportunity for facilities to increase their private pay rates to cover this unanticipated cost in their operating expenses. But because we do have equalization currently, we do have to come before you to address this increase. I will also say that the $2 figure in the bill was based on data that was collected at the end of February, and it determined that the average cost increase that nursing facilities have seen this season as compared to this time last year was 30%. So that 30% was translated to the $2 adjustment that you see in the bill. I would accept any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Meyer. Mr. Vossen, before we take questions.
Once again, my name is Jim Vossen, and you know who I'm with. I'm with USCW Local 653 with the Seniors and Workers for Quality, and we're here to speak in support of House File 3314. Just last year, we were able to realize the first increase in nursing home reimbursement in a few years, and that was vital to our ability to attract and retain staff in our facilities. Without workers, our facilities would just be rooming houses. We urge you to help us to avoid the risk of winter fuel costs cutting into nursing home staff budgets. We support a rate boost for winter heating and urge the money to be targeted as such. Again, it's unfortunate that we have to tailor our reimbursement system piece by piece. One day together, we'll have a reimbursement system rewards caring workers and recognize in advance that it gets cold in Minnesota in winter. So we thank you.
Thank you for your brevity, Mr. Vossen. That was fantastic. Any of one else in the audience that would like to testify to House File 3314? Seeing none, I will open it for questions. Members, Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, we don't have a fiscal note, but do we have a rough idea about how much this would cost?
Mr. Chair, members, yes, we have calculated that the impact to the state for this proposal would be a one-time expenditure of $1.8 million.
And Jeff, one question, follow-up. Here I've been going around claiming that I solved this increased heating cost by taking care of the weather with a mild January and so forth. Well, that didn't work either, did it? But you said 30%. I have actually talked to places that the incredibly mild January made a huge difference, and February for that matter as well. When you said 30%, are you talking about the rate difference, or are you actually talking about year-to-year cost for that month?
Ms. Meyer.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bradley, it is the year-to-year difference in the cost that facilities have received. And there is a differential. There are some facilities whose costs have gone up less than that. There are some facilities that have gone up more than that, but the average is 30%. In spite of the warm weather, thank you very much for that, by the way.
Thank you, Ms. Meyer. Further questions? Seeing none, the chair will hold over House File 3314 for possible inclusion. With the minutes?
I move the minutes.
Representative Pepin moves the minutes. All those in favor? I'm sorry. I thought we just all assumed it was March 14th. Thanks. Representative Pepin moves the March 14th minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Were you opposed?
Yeah.
All those opposed?
Yeah.
No. All right. The minutes are adopted. And the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.